The New Mexico Rural Heritage Oral History Project is a collaboration between anthropologists at New Mexico State University and the Oral History Program at the New Mexico Farm and Ranch Heritage Museum in Las Cruces, New Mexico. The goal of the project was to record the memories of New Mexicans who grew up in rural parts of the state in the first half of the 20th century. This podcast brings together some of those stories. Living in rural New Mexico in the early 1900s meant that goods and services weren't easily accessible. People would need to travel several miles into town for their shopping needs. Trading posts to barter various goods were also a good option in these remote parts. Another thing that made it tough was trying to find steady work to make a living wage. In this episode, we'll explore the commerce of rural New Mexico. Lebeo Martinez was born in 1930 in Dixon, New Mexico. He grew up in the same house he still lives in today. He describes how much money people used to make and the cost of attending school in the 30s.
People used to work for a dollar a day. Even the mission teachers that came from back east, that all they got paid was $30 a month. But they charged tuition $2 a month. So my dad had to pay, work 2 days somewhere for $2 to pay my tuition. Actually, my brother and sister, the same thing. So he needed $6 a month to pay our tuition to go to the mission school.
Daniel Olguin and his family moved to Washington Ranch in 1944, where he lived until 1951, when he left to join the Air Force.
Right after I got out of the Air Force, I worked on the cotton gin, and I was the one that, you know, it has a big old tube about this big around, and had two handles, and it sucks the cotton up into where it was ginning, and it separates the seed from the fiber. I worked on that one season, and it paid a dollar an hour. And that was big money. And you, like, if a trailer came in with two bales, you'd cut it in half. I was the one that, you know, sucked up all the cotton and stuff. Once in a while, there'd be a box of matches that would be sucked into the deal, and it'd cause a fire inside. So there was an alarm going off, you know, if there's a fire, and they stopped everything. But anyway. And it was a job because you jumped off of one trailer, run into another one, and then start all over again. And you'd work all day, and sometimes you'd work all night.
Cotton has been an important part of New Mexico's economy for centuries and has become a major commercial crop for the state. Lucille Wolf, who was born in Artesia in 1925, also recalls the cotton industry in Atoka, just outside of Artesia.
The store was across the road from a cotton gin. The farmers would bring in their cotton bollies and wagons, and they had a weighing station where they weighed it. Then they separated the cotton from the bollies, and the gin spit out the seeds of the cotton bollies into a big barn.
Felipe Baca was born in 1928 and spent most of his childhood living in La Cienega and Galisteo. When times were tough, families might resort to selling livestock. Felipe gives an example of a neighbor that needed to do just that, although the money received was not exactly put away safely in a bank.
Well, this man, you know, he only had, like I said, a daughter and a son. And before he died, he sold all his sheep and cattle. And he didn't believe in banks. So he kept all the money at home. So he went and buried it across I-25, which was then US 85. He used to go bury it over there under a tree for all the money that he got for the cattle and the sheep, you know. And then when he was dying, he kept telling Dad, "Cousin, I'm going to tell you something so that you and my daughter and son will never have to worry about being short of money and financial things." I'm going to tell him, he'd get to a certain point, and then he wouldn't come out with it. You know, he never told him. Well, he finally just died and never told him what the deal was. And I think he was probably trying to tell where and how to get to that money that he buried so that he could divide it between the son and the daughter and himself. That's what he was trying to imply, you know. but he never got to go. He died before he could say.
Besides working for an hourly wage, bartering goods was also a way to provide for the family. Once again, Lebeo Martinez.
We go in a horse and wagon up the road to Peñasco, which is 12, 13, 14 miles from here. And we take a bunch of fruit, you know, plums, pears, apples, whatever we had, melons, chili, whatever, and trade it for pumpkins and beans and peas and stuff like that.
Okay.
Even for chickens.
Amado Mares, born in 1934, talks about his father growing crops to trade. They also grew hay to feed livestock.
He used to plant a lot of potatoes to barter and provide. He grew his own hay in the meadows here. So everything that he did was barter. Cash never came in until October when the calves would sell and the lambs. But that with that cash would keep him over the winter, I guess. You know, in September, October, they had to cut the hay to feed the cattle and the sheep during the 5 months of the winter. So my father would give them, he'd bring in a couple of laborers and give them hay, give them a lamb or a cow or something. And they would do the work, my mother. Mother would, she would cook the meals for all the laborers.
Bronson Springstead was born in 1936 in Chaco Canyon. His father, who went by the nickname Colonel, owned a trading post.
Everything else that they traded for, goods, they paid off in the fall with lambs, wool, mohair, pelts, rugs, jewelry, whatever they could make. The payday was in the fall. They paid all their accounts in the fall. So I can remember, they would take me out of school because he would have 5,000 head of lambs that we had to drive to Gallup to the railroad.
Monty Shriver was born in El Dorado in 1934 and grew up in Aztec, New Mexico. There were 2 drugstores, 3 grocery stores, and a bank. Grocery stores at that time worked on credit because farmers didn't always have cash.
And you could charge groceries in. They would write down, each of them had their little books, and they could write down each item and what the price was, and then you would charge it. The farmers didn't always have money, so they would charge it, and then after a while they'd start bugging you for a little money. And what was funny, certainly since Parfield and Don Gay would stand outside their business to see who was going into which store to charge groceries. If your bill got a little high here, or then you'd go into Gay's, or you'd go into Hubbard's.
We come back to Lucille Wolf, whose father owned general stores in Atoka, and later in Alamogordo and Deming.
My father sold everything. He had a grease rack, and he sold gasoline, and he had kerosene. He had vinegar by the barrel people bought in. Quart jars and got vinegar. He sold shoes, he sold car batteries, he sold tires, he sold material, thread, he had a meat market, he sold cigarettes and stuff like that. He also sold fencing to the farmers because they could bring it in on the train. And the farmers could unload it into their wagons and take the fence back home. So Dad sold everything. It was a general mercantile.
Mary Ellen Warren was born in 1927 on the Sierra Grande Ranch. Her family would go 10 miles north into Deming, New Mexico to run their errands.
At the time that I was growing up, they had, I think, 3 grocery stores, and they had a hardware store. They had a drug store, and they had a telephone office, which got all the telephone. You know, it was one of those plug-in things. I know we used to order, maybe it was from Montgomery Ward, I don't know, things like prunes, and they'd come in the big box. But usually we went to Clayton to buy our groceries a lot of times. We'd just get essentials there in Des Moines. Of course, flour and sugar, salt, those were the main things that we bought because we pretty well had everything.
Lonnie Harper was born in 1936. In this clip, he gives insight into stores keeping food fresh in the 1940s.
They had the first to come out that I remember
in the late 40s was your grocery stores, your little country grocery stores, put in what we call frozen food locker plants. And they would put in maybe a block of 50 to 100 little compartments, a big room that was refrigerated and kept it probably 15 to 20 degrees below zero, the whole room. And then you have a locker that you'd rent for $50 a year or something like that. And they'd freezer wrap, you know, your meat and put it in the freezer. And it'd last about a year without freezer burn. And that really helped the butchering business. And my dad and one of my older brothers, they later had, my oldest brother actually later ran his own little slaughter plant. He did it up at Farmington, New Mexico for about 20 years, where he would go out and slaughter an animal for all the farmers for their own freezer. And then he'd cut and wrap it and put it into a quick freeze, and he'd charge them so much for cutting and wrapping. And he'd take it by the order, you know, how big, how thick you like your steaks, and how big a package to make your hamburger meat in, too.
Besides freezers, canning has been a way to preserve food since the early 1800s. Daniel Olkin recalls trips to the grocery store to fill up his truck with canned goods.
With $12, you could fill the back end of the pickup with canned goods or flour and all kinds of stuff, $10 to $15. And now, with $15, you can just carry them in one little bag. Things were, a box of matches was 5 cents. And now, I think it's like three boxes for about $5, something like that. I buy them by three boxes in one bundle. And so things have changed so drastic.
Monty Shriver returns once again to describe mail order catalogs, a precursor to our modern online shopping. Although many things have changed since the early 1900s, one thing that hasn't is being a kid on Christmas.
We had the Sears and Roebuck catalog, mm-hmm, and the Montgomery catalog. And the big thing was, when it was getting to be Christmas time, we would always pour through those catalogs and point out to our folks what we wanted as a gift. Yeah, that was a big thing. Thanks for reminding me about catalogs. And of course, catalogs were recycled, mm-hmm, at the outhouses.
That concludes this episode of the New Mexico Rural Heritage Oral History Project. All interviews were conducted or supervised by Kelly Jenks, Mary Alice Scott, Kayla Archuleta Brown, and Mariah Ballard. On behalf of New Mexico State University, I'm Jose Loera. Thank you for tuning in. This oral history project was made possible in part by a grant from the New Mexico Humanities Council. Additional funding was provided by the Loomis Foundation and the Southwestern Border Cultures Institute at New Mexico State University. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this presentation do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities, the New Mexico Humanities Council, or New Mexico State University. The full interviews are available at the New Mexico Farm and Ranch Heritage Museum in Las Cruces, New Mexico. More information is available at the museum website at nmfarmandranchmuseum.org.